Good morning. We'll call the Fiscal Committee to order for the meeting of June 18th. And note that in addition to our usual members, we have replacements. Representative Wallner replacing Representative Leishman, Representative Birdsell replacing Representative Morse. Senator Birdsell replacing Senator Morse.
I'm telling Senator Morse.
Well, I said you have the same problem. Once you serve as somebody to represent, you
So, I will caution all members, we have a revised agenda. You can tell it because it doesn't have that usual piece at the top to explain why we're in Zoom. So, we'll begin with the acceptance of the minutes of May 21st, 2021.
Move the minutes.
Second.
Okay, a motion to accept by Senator D'Alessandro, seconded by Senator Gaida. Any corrections or omissions? All right. Do we still have to call a roll?
No, we don't.
All right. All in favor, raise your hands. The motion is adopted. Okay, moving on to...
You abstained, is that correct?
Okay. That's right.
Well, that's what I figured.
All right. The motion is adopted and the minutes are accepted. We have no old business. We're moving on to tab 3 in our new consent calendar.
I remove consent calendar. Be adopted.
Okay, so that includes... Fiscal items 147, 148, 149.
Second.
Motion and a second to adopt that consent calendar under tab 3. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, raise your hand. The motion is adopted. Moving on to tab 4. And again.
Chairman, I would move the adoption of consent calendar under tab 4.
Second.
A motion by Representative Ober, second by Senator Rosenwald to adopt tab 4, and that includes items 21, 151, 153, 154, 155, 159, 164. Any further discussion? Seeing none. All in favor of adopting the consent calendar under tab 4, raise your hand. That motion passes. So the next item would be tab 5. We're moving on to a single item for 21-157. Find our way through all
of 157.
Second.
Okay, a motion by Representative Ober, second by Senator D'Alessandro to adopt item number 157. All in favor, raise your hand. That motion is adopted. Okay, moving on to tab 6. Department of Corrections, 21-158. A motion by Representative Ober to approve, second by Representative Emmerich on item number 21-158. Any further discussion?
No.
Seeing none, all in favor, raise your hand. That motion is adopted. Okay, now we move on to the American Rescue Plan.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question on items 21-150 and 21-152.
I do as well. Do we have someone from Health and Human Services ready to answer a question?
Mr. Chairman, while we're moving things off, I would also remove 166 and 168.
We'll do each of these separately.
All right, that means each one will be separate.
We got to.
There's no motion.
Okay.
We approved the consent calendar.
Not this one.
What tab is this?
This is tab seven.
Okay, sorry. What do we mean? Are we removing something or?
Every one of them.
Okay.
Okay, let me find item 150.
Is there a motion?
That's easy, I know that one.
Not yet. We have questions. We have no motion as of yet. You have someone from health?
No motion to remove them from the calendar?
This chair is really short.
I don't need to do that?
There's just a place who asked to remove it, and it's.
I guess, okay.
And we don't need a motion. Okay, let me get through all these.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. Welcome the.
Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
And I know for the ARPA funds, we are primarily, or I guess overall, waiting for additional guidance for how we're going to spend. So I have your two items relate to childcare stabilization grants and childcare development fund. And I noticed both of them were going into class 102, which is contracts for program services. So I wondered, does that mean, I'm just going to show how little I know about this, so just don't burst into laughter. I wondered if that meant only childcare providers who have a contract with HHS are eligible, or if you're actually going to be writing contracts with everyone who gets grants from these. So, Karen, I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, this is Chris Santinello, Department of Health and Human Services. I'll answer what we're going to do, and then Karen can say how it all happens. How does that work? Okay? Because I'm not sure about some of those pieces. So, we did receive guidance for the stabilization dollars. Okay? So, that's the $47 million. We are very close to finalizing our plan. We're really close to it. And there's very strict federal guidance on how we use those dollars. 90% has to go directly to child care providers. And so throughout the pandemic, we have been paying them through New Hampshire First. Is that the right way? Okay. So I don't know exactly what, we don't have contracts. They're either licensed, exempt, licensed, but we've been paying them through New Hampshire First. So I'm not sure what class line that would be. And then the $29 million.
Have you got the red button pushed down?
Yes.
Into hold?
Yeah, they're good.
Very good.
Okay. Then the $29 million, we just received the guidance yesterday or the day before. I have not gone through it. That money we have until 2024 to spend. So we'll be working on the plan for that, and that's we're not exactly sure how that money will go out. But I think we can transfer.
Yes, yeah, so to further answer that question, it would not restrict us to contracts that are already in place or current providers. As Chris spoke to, the current providers, I believe it's in statute how it works, so it doesn't require a contract. But if we were to work with providers that we don't currently have that agreement with, we would create new contracts. So it doesn't restrict us. And like Chris said, we could transfer funds later if we find that we need to move it to, say, like 563 or something that's child in the child care budget or something like that.
Follow up.
Chris, on the child care stabilization grant, you already have a guidance almost 90% there. Is there something in there that asks you to look at those with the highest amount of need? I haven't read that guidance, so.
Yep. So the guidance is, the federal guidance is really focused on stabilization, right? And so in New Hampshire, we've had a three-pronged approach, really, and, you know, emergency, stabilization, and now we're moving to continued stabilization and recovery. And so the way there's, we base the grant awards on the operating budgets of the child care providers. And so 90% of the funds go towards them, but the guidance is pretty clear. It goes towards wages and benefits, rent and utilities, cleaning and sanitation, supplies, material goods. So it's pretty prescribed how they use it, but we do a formula based on their actual operating. So we're still finessing some of that, and a lot of that we will not know until we see how many providers actually provide. We do have to obligate 50% of our funds
Tracy.
By December 2021. So,
thank you. Mm-hmm. Just one last question. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're going to have this all laid out. You must be going to have some kind of internal report showing who got what money and how.
Yes, we do have that actually now for all dollars we've given out.
Mr. Chairman, would it be possible to ask that a copy of that report be put in our packets as an informational item when they're done?
Yes, we would like some follow-up. Mm-hmm. This is a lot of money.
I agree.
Senator Rosenwald for
You're
a question.
Welcome.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning.
Is the department planning to use any of this, these two sources of funds for enrollment-based reimbursement, and if so, how much?
So not yet, because the stabilization dollars, we're not allowed to use it for that. So the larger pot of the money would have to go towards areas that the federal government has said we could use it. So that is not an option. The $29 million that goes until 2024, we could potentially look at a portion of that, but that would really, we would need to engage stakeholders on, is that the best use of those funds? So some of the, what we've talked about internally is maybe doing a pilot with some strong bookends, because $29 million is a lot of money, but it'll go pretty quickly. And so we want to make sure we're being very mindful of our dollars so that we get the focus is really on moving out of the pandemic, building the system stronger. And so that would be something we would look at.
Follow up.
So could you please briefly describe the process of working with the stakeholders the department will use?
So we haven't finalized that yet, because we just received the guidance yesterday, and we have until 2024 to spend the dollar. So our focus is first on the stabilization. But what we will do is meet with Child Care Advisory Council, go through the Council for Thriving Children, you know, send, you know, solicit input from families, from child care providers, to understand exactly how the best use of those dollars would be.
Representative Edwards has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good seeing you
nice
again.
To see you.
I have a few questions that kind of fit together. So in answer to Representative Ober's question about whether or not there are needs-based criteria to prioritize those in, with greater need, I think the short answer that you gave is no. There is not a needs-based component of the grant process.
So one of the things we are considering is base awards, okay, that's based on the operating budget and a percent of that, and then the opportunity to apply to have additional percents added to your dollar amount based on certain priorities of the department, such as serving children on child care scholarship, who are our most vulnerable children, enrolling in the New Hampshire scholarship program. So we're trying to build it, and it's not finalized yet, as a way to do that. But we can't say, the rules don't allow us to say, okay, if Center X has higher need than Center Z, then you have to give more to this center than that center. We're basing it on number of children, and it's based on their operating budgets.
Could you tell me two components, because I'm looking for a percentage here.
Okay.
Approximately how many child care providers have some type of contract with the department, and how many total are there in the state? I'm kind of looking for a percentage of coverage.
Right.
Trying to figure out how many providers we have that are out in the cold and won't be able to get at this money.
No, so we don't have contracts. A child care center that or provider is those that are licensed, so or licensed exempt. So those are the and there's about just under 800 or so, and also school programs that don't have to be licensed, like the Boys and Girls Clubs, the YMCA programs, they're able to get it. We just can't give it to babysitters. So if I was somebody who was caring for my neighbor and I wasn't a license-exempt provider, that's not who the money would go towards. But anyone who's licensed, license-exempt, is eligible to receive the funding. And we've been doing that all along.
Okay. Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So sort of the final summary, because I'm just trying to make sure I understand what all this information means in the real world, is it sounds like I'm never going to hear from a child care provider saying, we're struggling, and it's too hard to do the paperwork with DHHS, and as a result, I wasn't able to get access to that $47 million of federal money. I'm never going to hear that.
I would never say never, because I can't predict what people will say to you. But we are making the application process extremely simple. We actually, when we received the CURSA dollars in February, we did an application that probably had 8 questions, and it was all done online, so it was very simple. And we actually work very closely with Child Care Aware of New Hampshire to assist child care providers with the application. We do webinars. We have office hours. So we try to make it as simple as possible.
Any further questions? Senator Guida.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would these funds be available for small communities that have after-school programs for kids?
Yes.
Thank you.
Further questions? I have one. What is the size of your current budget for child care?
$34 million?
It's around 35. It's around 35 or 40 million.
That's what I thought.
Yep.
This
yes.
is more money than we've ever had for child care.
Correct. And I think
some of it goes multi-years.
Yes, but this $49 million, which, you know, we only have until 2023 to spend, I think, 2023. So I just want to make sure.
So for 2 years anyway, this money is...
Yeah, and then the other dollars is until 2024. So it is a big amount of money, and really our focus on the... On the discretionary funds is really what's the long-term sustainability of these dollars, right? Because we have given a lot of resources, and we know childcare was fragile pre-pandemic, so we have to build it back stronger because, you know, this money will run out.
Okay. Any further questions? I need a motion to pass.
Second.
We have 2 items. Which one are you?
Well, we thoroughly discussed 150, so I would move to approve 150. I don't think we have questions on the next one.
Okay.
Second.
Both of mine at the same time, but I don't know about others.
All right. Representative Ober moves to approve item number 150, and Senator Rosenwald seconds. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, raise your hand. The motion passes. Okay, now moving on to 152.
If there are no questions, I move to approve 152.
Representative Ober moves to approve, and Senator Rosenwald seconds to accept item FIS 21-152. Is there any further discussion on that item? Seeing none, all in favor, raise your hand. That motion is adopted unanimously.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, we're moving on now to the next item, which was removed, FIS 21-166 for the Department of Transportation. We'll welcome anybody from that department to come forward for questions. See some familiar faces here. Marie Mullen and Mr. Can't remember, Cass? No.
Hurley.
Yes. For the record, Marie Mullen, Director of Finance for DOT.
And Patrick Hurley, Director of Aeronautics, Rail and Transit for DOT.
Senator Daniels for a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question had to do with the funding of the buses. My understanding is that there's money that would go to, like, the Manchester Transit Authority, National Transit Authority. My question pertains to those chutes of buses. For instance, I live in Milford. There is a bus that is part of the National Transit Authority that
yes.
goes out into the towns.
Correct.
And is funded by the towns, at least
Correct.
Partially.
Yes.
Would any of this money go toward reducing the cost to the towns of that service, or is that going to be left up to the Transit Authority?
That's going to be left up, Patrick Hurley again, that's going to be left up primarily to the Transit Authority and the towns themselves. The ARP funding that we're receiving out of this grant is 100% federally funded, so that's been giving relief to both the transit agencies and the towns up to this point. But how that goes further, you know, farther along we go, what the relationships between the transit agencies and the towns will be up to them to decide.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Rosenwald for a
Thank
question.
Thank you. Will any of this money end up with the Boston Express Company?
Yes.
So we might have some leverage getting the bus to go to the airport.
How did I know this question was coming?
Because I ask it every opportunity.
I know you
I
do.
Have.
We continue to evaluate providing services to the airport. Again, we've provided two services prior to the airport. One, the East-West Express, which was from Portsmouth over to Manchester Airport, as well as Manchester Transit Authority did a direct service to the airport from Concord. They were not successful, quite honestly. They did not work. Manchester Airport will still provide service to the airport, but you'd have to go from Concord, transfer in Manchester down to Veterans Park, and then go over to the airport. The Boston Express is a commuter service. If we did implement something to the airport, we would have to look at how that would fit into the schedule. And scheduling is a very delicate issue because people want to get on, you know, get to a location as soon as they can.
Follow up.
Thank you. Has the department ever tested service from Nashua to Manchester Airport, though?
We have not, and I would challenge Nashua Transit System to try that. I think that would be a good opportunity for Nashua Transit to provide service to the airport.
Thank you.
Further questions on item 166? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to adopt.
Second.
Senator D'Alessandro moves the item. Senator Daniels seconds to adopt FIS 166. Any further discussion? Seeing none, you're ready for the question. All in favor, raise your hand. The motion is adopted unanimously, and we'll move on to the next item.
Thank you.
My apologies, Patrick.
It's okay.
I do know your name.
You do have some affiliation with aviation, I guess.
Yes, we both mutually kind of. I should have known it right off.
That's okay. Good representative.
All right. Representative Ober moves item 168.
I have a question for the department.
All right. We'll get a second, and then we'll have
second.
A discussion.
I'll second.
Second from Senator Rosenwald, Department of Justice. We see our new Attorney General here for the first time. To the
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to see everyone in person.
Attorney for Miller.
Yeah.
And a question from Representative Daniels.
Representative Daniels. Thank you. The question pertains to the distribution of the funds and how they're going to be used.
Yep.
In the $2 million that's being appropriated, it talks about due to relaxed COVID-19 rules and restrictions and increased post-pandemic demand for travel, hospitality, tourism, and other services. How will this money be used in those areas?
Yep. Thanks for the question. So for a little bit of background, just to give you some context, the Department of Justice got about $3.4 million under the CARES Act to assist municipalities and state agencies with costs during COVID. A lot of those grants went to overtime and PPE and other decontamination equipment, new ventilators. So this will be a little bit different, but it's similar. We anticipate coming out of COVID that this is going to be, for lack of a better term, a blowout summer. There's going to be a lot of activity, especially up in the Lakes region, over in Hampton, in the population centers. And the thought behind this money is that municipalities may need some assistance with overtime, perhaps equipment that they don't have, barricades, things like that, for events in which they get maybe even greater than expected numbers or greater numbers than in past years. So we're just anticipating there's going to be some additional law enforcement and security activity, potentially some additional EMS activity associated with all of the increased activity this summer. So one of the things we've been talking about for the past couple months is that this summer could not only be, it's not just that we're going to recover from COVID, we think we're going to see a spike in activity given the pent-up demand. So the goal is to have some funds available to assist municipalities and state agencies, primarily state police, perhaps the National Guard, if they see increased costs.
Follow-up
question.
Could any of these funds be used by DOT to further man toll booths, in particular those toll booths that they don't have a human being there, like on a third shift?
Yes. Yeah. If we try to write this broadly to cover state agencies for anything that might be related to increased activity, so yes, if DOT felt there was a need, they could come to us, we'd look at it, and we would potentially grant them some funds. If it were over $100,000, they would have to come here. But in any event, they'd have to go to GNC.
Thank you.
Further questions on the item? We have a motion and a second.
Move the item.
Yeah, we've already got that motion. All in favor, raise your hand. That item is adopted. Moving on to...
Thank you.
How does Senator Guida vote? He didn't raise his hand.
Senator Guida, did you vote?
No. You vote no? Thank you very much.
All opposed? Okay, thank you. Thank you for catching that. And we're moving on now to tab 8, which is another consent calendar, it looks like. Well, there's just one item. 21-156, Fish and Game. I'll entertain a motion to adopt the item. Senator D'Alessandro moves to adopt, and Representative Obers seconds. Any questions on Fish and Game? Seeing none, all in favor adopting the item, raise your hand. Any opposed? Item is adopted. I would note that I'm glad that we finally had a hike safety card. Some of us, it took 10 years for the department to adopt it, but now it's covering the spread on the cost difference between search and what the funds cover. All right, moving on to item number, let's see, tab 9. We're on to item number FIS 21-169, Department of Health and Human Services.
This is also consent.
Did someone ask to take this off consent? Well, there are two items on the consent. If there's no, there's five. Does anyone wish to remove any of the five items?
I'd like to remove item 170 and 173.
Okay, 170 and 173 removed by Senator Daniels. Any other requests to remove? Okay, three items remaining on tab 9 for a consent calendar. I'll entertain a motion for the remaining items.
Move.
Senator D'Alessandro moves to adopt the remaining items. Second by Representative Emmerich. For any further discussion, seeing none, all in favor, raise your hand. Any opposed? It's unanimous. So That applied to items number 21-169, 21-171, and 21-172 have all been covered in that vote. And so now we'll move to item 21-170 from the Employment Security, and Senator Daniels has a question. Commissioner Kapatas, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, George Kapatas, Commissioner of Employment Security. I'm joined by Deputy Commissioner Richard Livers and Administrator Joe Revels.
Is the red button down? Couldn't tell if you were on or not. You got to be fairly close. Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Daniels for a question.
Yeah, thank you. Knowing that the Department of Employment Security has discontinued funds going to people that have been out of work with now a requirement that they be looking for work, and I believe that the federal government is doing the same thing, discontinuing the distribution of funds, or is that continuing?
The state distribution of federal funds is discontinuing. The federal funds that we receive are discontinuing.
Okay. Are there federal funds?
And those funds would be the $300 additional that everybody receives that is on state unemployment, as well as the $300 everybody receives that's not eligible for state unemployment. They're in either the expansion of the PUA program plus the federal monies that they receive as well.
Okay. Thank
all
you.
Those programs are ending.
Okay. Follow up. Are any of the states around us having any kind of an incentive program like this $10 million is proposing to do?
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, Senator. I know the state of Maine just recently announced a very similar program, almost copied verbatim from what is proposed here. I'm not sure if Massachusetts or Vermont are planning anything similar right now.
Okay. Final follow-up?
Follow-up.
So how do we justify spending the $10 million when people now are not receiving any funds at home, and really it's necessary to go to work, and everywhere you go there are signs wanting help? So how do we justify offering an incentive for somebody to go out to work that isn't receiving any money?
Well, I think the department wants to do everything within its power in order to incentivize these workers, because the deputy commissioner and myself are getting calls on a daily basis from employers that aren't able to fill positions, that have significant numbers of positions they're trying to fill. So what we're trying to do is to do everything within our power in order to incentivize these people to get back to work, because, you know, now is the time to get back to work. I will say our job fairs that we've been doing, we've done 21 job fairs so far, and we've had over 8,000 people that have showed up for those job fairs. So, like I said, we're getting calls on a daily basis. I mean, I was just, you know, and the deputy commissioner, I was just dealing with an employer the other day that, you know, can't fill positions.
And I would just add to what the commissioner had said there. We are seeing some significant bounce in the policy decisions that have been made over the last few months. You look at late April when the governor announced the return of the work search requirement. We've had 13,000 people fall off the unemployment rolls since then. And then we go to the end of May when the governor announced the end of the federal programs and the creation of the summer stipend program. We've seen 7,000 people that have stopped filing during that time. So based upon the numbers that we're seeing, these policy decisions do appear to be having a significant impact. When you look at what Massachusetts is experiencing right now with the speed of workforce recovery, it's really no comparison between New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and that's true nationally as well. So some of these policy decisions are making significant improvements and properly motivating people to get back to the workforce and retain that employment like we're looking to do with this program.
And you are confirming my point, is that as the money stops flowing in to the unemployed worker, that they are needing to get out to go to work. So why do we need to add another $10 million on top of an incentive that they already have of zero coming in?
Yeah, and I think the point I was trying to make is that a lot of the return to employment, the numbers that we're seeing are driven by these policy decisions that have been made. What we are seeing with the virtual job fairs that we've been conducting, that the commissioner was talking about, we've had three this week, attracted 3,000 job seekers. People are still being really selective with the positions that they are looking to get back into. I think some of it is folks recognizing that it's a job seeker market. And in some instances, I think they're overplaying their hand as well. So what we're trying to do here, along with the end of the federal programs, is to appropriately incentivize people to get back into the workforce, and hopefully we won't see such the types of behaviors that we're starting to see on these job fairs, where people are being very selective in the kind of the demands and the flexibilities that they're asking from employers, and hopefully a stipend like this will assist with those folks taking that next job.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Guider for a question.
It would appear that the incentive of hunger or the depletion of personal savings, we're not thinking about the thousands and thousands of people who are working and righteously who are not going to get an extra payment because they're working. I find this objectionable. I understand, but the incentive to me is in an economy such as ours, if you don't want to work, you have the right to not work. That's your choice. We don't have an obligation to pay you because you don't want to work. And so I'm not supporting this program, and I would ask you, I'd ask my colleagues to consider that as well. Thank you.
Senator D'Alessandro for a question.
Thank you. First of all, thanks very much for what you're doing. I think incentivizing and doing the job fairs is vitally important. What's the labor pool like in terms of aggregate numbers of bodies that are available for work? You said that a few thousand showed up, but really, what's the real number of unemployed at this point in time?
So, Senator, we have right now, with the numbers that were reported yesterday, we have 24,000 people approximately filing for benefits across all programs. So that's state and federal programs. That's about 12,000 people in the regular state program, and then the balance of that are in either the federal expansion or federal extension. Those are the people that we're working with to try to find them the right fit for that next position. I do think a lot of these folks, with how selective they are being, it tells me that in many cases they're not the primary earner in the household, so they tend to be a little bit more selective.
Sure. Follow-up?
And what's the skill set that they bring to the table? I mean, you interview them at a job fair. We talk about the desire for a skilled labor force, and that skilled labor force obviously is great for the economy here, but what skills are they bringing forward at this point?
We are seeing a lot of people that are, you know, people that are returning back to the sector in which they last worked, right? So skilling up for those folks is less, and they're able to go right back into a position. But we are seeing a lot of other folks that you've read about this, but it's very real, are people that have had done some thinking during the pandemic about what they want to do next. And for those folks, these virtual job fairs are a great opportunity where we're able to connect them with training resources, community college system, and so forth, and try to, if they're eligible for one of our training programs that could pay for a portion of that training, they're able to talk with employment service folks at that job fair.
Last question is to
Senator.
So another component of this is workforce development. You get people coming to your fairs obviously there's the incentive, but indeed the workforce development pointing them in the right direction. And we know that the changes have to take place in terms of their skill level at this point versus what their skill level has to be to get the decent job that they're looking for.
Senator Rosenwald for a question.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Rosenwald is recognized.
We've heard that the tourist sector is expected to be very strong this summer. What can you tell us about the number of jobs that need to be filled right away in those related industries?
So, tourism-related employers have been very active in participating in all our reemployment efforts that we've had over the last few months, particularly. So we've done two rounds of virtual job fairs hitting every region of the state over the last month. Our hospitality and our restaurant employers have been have turned out very well for all of those events. So we continue to look at doing further events with them, whether it be an in-person recruitment event in our offices. We've done some other sector-specific virtual job fairs as well, where we've had the hospitality sector, construction industry. We've done events for single employers, you know, Easter Seals. We've done a few events for them, and we have some that will be coming up for the child care industry as well to help them connect with workforce. So they're trying to fill positions, and they're competing with other sectors right now. So I think it's imperative that we do all that we can to incentivize as many people as we can to get back into the workforce to fill these positions. And this is another tool that we have to assist with creating that incentive.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Do you know how many open jobs there are in the tourist-related sector?
Tourism specifically, I don't have that number, but we can get it to you. The most recent job opening and posting data that we reviewed, there were about 16,000 positions statewide that were being recruited for.
There's 16,000 hospitality jobs in North
Carolina. Senator Birdsell for a question.
Thank you, and thanks for taking my question. I've talked to a couple of employers in my area, and they've had continuous problems with people agreeing to come to an interview and then just not showing up. And it's putting a pretty much of a burden on them. Are the individuals, is there any way to track those individuals who agree? Because I know when I was filling out years ago when I was unemployed and I had to fill out employment information in order to get my unemployment check, whether or not I interviewed, are any of these tracked?
So we have employers do regularly report to us when an individual declines an offer of employment. We are statutorily obligated to review each of those, and we look at the employment offered. We look at whether it was suitable for the under the circumstances for that individual, and then if it was determined suitable, then they would be denied benefits going forward. We do also hear from employers like those that have contacted you regarding what is commonly being referred to as ghosting at these interviews.
Okay.
You know, we encourage employers to report that to us as well, because a component of the weekly work search requirement right now is an individual needs to document to us who they have applied to and how they've done that. And so that information is helpful as we evaluate whether or not someone has satisfied that weekly work search requirement.
Thank you.
Further questions? I'll entertain a motion to adopt FIS 21-170.
I will be added.
Senator D'Alessandro moves to adopt. Is there a second?
Yes, I'll second.
Senator Rosenwald seconds. Further discussion? Seeing none, if you're in favor, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Those opposed? One, two, three. I counted wrong.
Seven.
It's got a total 10. 7-3. That's just that I do budgets, you know. Don't hold me to numbers. These numbers are too small. Thank you, gentlemen. We'd appreciate after the 8 weeks when you've, everybody that has applied, if you would send us a note on what the participation was.
Sure.
In this program, and hopefully it works. We're investing quite a bit of money in it.
60,000.
It'll cover 1,000 people anyway, right?
All right. So, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Ten thousand people. All right. Moving on to item 173. Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery. You probably have Director Caswell here.
Sir. Hey, Bob. Yes, good morning. I'm here today as Executive Director of Gopher, and Chase Hageman here is our Deputy Director.
Senator Daniels has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, and congratulations on your reconfirmation.
Thank you, sir.
As we look, the $3 million here is going to be designated to fund COVID-19 homeowner and homeownership hardships. My question is, what criteria are you going to be using for this? Because I have heard of instances where people have received significant funding during the time that they were unemployed, but rather than pay their rents, which would probably be a hardship type thing, they are out buying things that others might consider non-essential, like TVs or recreational things. So how are you going to determine the criteria on who gets this money?
So a couple things, Senator. First, with regard to the rental component, that program is in operation right now through New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. And it's a rental emergency assistance program specifically for the rental market. This funding that we have here today is for a separate program that has not yet been designed. And in fact, the resources that are requested here that would be used by New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority would be to establish the criteria that you're talking about, but it would be exclusively for mortgage delinquencies and foreclosure situations, so people who are in an ownership situation. So the design of the components of that program is what we need to be able to provide the federal government in order to access the bigger pot of money for that specific purpose.
Okay, so I used the wrong language, but we're talking the same thing.
Yes.
Someone who is responsible for a mortgage does not pay the mortgage because, you know, the government had said you don't have to pay. And now they're in a hardship situation because they didn't responsibly use the money that was coming into them to keep up with things. How are you going to determine?
Yeah, there are certain provisions in all of these programs that sort of seek to be able to avoid that situation. But in a lot of cases, these are resources that are either going to the landlord in the rental situation or to individuals. And there is probably a limit to the extent that that can be completely guarded against.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Guider for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, good to see you. I would submit that requiring the mortgagor to co-sign a check would be a good way to make sure that it gets to its intended destination.
Yeah.
Possible?
Yeah, no, I think that would be possible, Senator. What you're going to get with the funding that is in front of you right now, the $3 million, is a pretty substantial process that New Hampshire Housing Finance would administer for public hearings with banks, with mortgage holders, but with homeowners as well and advocates. So it's a process that will be pretty inclusive of all of the aspects that you're raising and Senator Daniels are raising.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Senator Rosenwald.
Thank you. Will this program be available to commercial mortgage owners as well? mean, if you own a multifamily unit that you rent out.
No, I believe these are specific for homeowners. Is that correct, Rachel?
Individual homeowners.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to adopt item FIS 21-173.
So
Senator Rosenwald moves the item.
Second.
Senator Guidus.
Hey, you look alike, right? Okay, so it's Delisandro and Guidus.
It's been a long week.
Yes, I understand. I appreciate it.
The budget just ground me down. I'm lucky that I made it here. All right. All those in favor, raise your hand. Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. That concludes the regular items on the agenda. There's many information items that any of the committee members wish to inquire about from the departments on any of the information items. Senator Rosenwald.
I have a quick question on the Health and Human Services dashboard.
Okay, Health and Human Services, questions on the dashboard, which is...
Oh, it's 167.
167. And we have Commissioner Chivinette as well as Ms. Rounds, the CEO. Welcome to Fiscal. Again,
hi.
For Ms. Rounds.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, I noticed the Medicaid caseload numbers are reported as of the end of February, and I'm wondering if the department can follow up with our committee prior to the next fiscal meeting with more updated caseloads.
You should have it in your inbox before this meeting is over. I sent it to Kevin Ripple 10 minutes ago.
Thank you very much.
Well, you know, Representative Vogt-Rafter, yesterday where you told me that I could never lie and could never make a mistake, and we verified that I will never lie, but I will always make mistakes. We'll just put that tick mark on that list. Right, mistakes happen. So to give you a number for May, it's 220,788. That includes expansion. Before expansion, it's 144,520. So it's pretty close to February still. Yeah, the expansion population has gone up about 4,000 cases, and standard has gone up about 1,000.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I mean, the next question is, can you make the type smaller?
I definitely can. It's hard, right, because I know that you want to see lots of data. One of the projects that we were undertaking, and I'm sure you remember me testifying to this before COVID, was redoing this dashboard to make it more user-friendly, more readable. Lisa English was the lead on that project, and as you all know, she now works for the governor's office. So as soon as we have a new lead for that project, we'll be working on making this a better document. You're welcome.
Nice anticipation. All right.
Either that or send us magnifying glass.
I guess we don't need a vote on this, but we appreciate the information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other items that anyone has questions on? If there are none, I see Steve Smith here to tell us about audits. And in disguise is Brock Romano. And Commissioner, you can look on with me.
I'll go get him. Just keep going.
Okay.
Are we here, or did we skip over this?
Oh, we did. Senator Daniels reminds me that we had also the information materials on previous audits for both the Liquor Commission and Department of Education. Did anybody want to have any further information on those? If so, we'll do it after this audit briefing. Does anybody want to talk about?
I had a comment on 163.
Okay, we'll have a comment on 163 afterwards. That's the Department of Education. Does anybody hear from them? Welcome, folks.
No, she won't be able to.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, good to see you all in person again.
It is good.
For the record, I'm Steve Smith, Director of Audits for the LDA. And with me this morning is Mark Romano. He's
The partner with KPMG. We retain them for the single audit. And also Dana Call, State Comptroller, and Commissioner Arlinghouse will be discussing admin services. Before I turn it over to Brock, I just wanted to, again, express my appreciation. This was a unique year, audit cycle for us, with the remote status, COVID, and all the competing priorities amongst the state agencies and folks. But I just, yeoman work on their part to get us to this point. And just want to thank them as well as all the departments and agencies that participate or had programs under audit. So we finished it. So again, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Romano.
Yes, good morning, everybody. For the record, my name is Brock Romano. I'm an audit partner with KPMG. And I'm going to walk through the results of the fiscal year 20 uniform guidance audit. As you can tell from the package, it's quite an overwhelming document. So what I'd like to do today is maybe talk about what is contained in the document you have. Ultimately, the goal is to share with you the results of the audit work relative to your largest federal programs. But to do that, if you would indulge me, I'd like to maybe have you flip to the table of contents, maybe just to describe what is contained in the document. You can see that there's in several sections. The sections A through C are primarily information that the committee has seen before, particularly in section C. That's the state's audited CAFR financial statements, which has been previously presented, is replicated in this document. So I won't spend time talking about it, but I wanted the committee to know that it's contained in here. Really, the relevant sections are sections D through G that relate to the state's federal programs. And if I could draw your attention to the table of contents, the schedule of expenditures of federal awards, this is basically the equivalent of a financial statement. So if you're familiar with a financial statement that has assets, liabilities, revenues, and expenses, this schedule is really just a schedule of what the state spent in terms of federal dollars. And if you kind of think about the goal of an audit, when we do an audit of a financial statement, it's to opine on balances and to opine activity. When we do an audit of federal programs, the goal is not to opine on balances, but is to opine on levels of compliance with those federal programs. And what I'd like to do now is maybe, you know, have you flip to sections F1 and F2, because that is what we call the summary of auditor's results, and what it will do is summarize the main points of the audit and the results. And so if I could kind of have you focus on F2 for a minute. I'm going to take them in a little bit of reverse order, but F2 basically lists the programs that we audited, and wanted to take a moment just to explain how we go about picking the programs for audit. It's based upon the guidance put out by the federal government. It focuses on largest programs. So basically, we focus on those programs that are that where the state spent more than $11 million based upon the federal guidelines. And just to put it in context, the state has about 20 programs that are above that $11 million threshold. Those programs, those 20 programs, those largest programs, represent over 90% of the spend in that schedule of expenditures that I mentioned earlier. So the state spent about $3.8 billion. The 20 largest programs accounted for over 90% of that spend. And if you look at those largest 20 programs, we selected 12 of them to audit this year, and we selected two programs below that threshold because the federal government asked us to focus on largest programs, but they also have some criteria for selecting smaller programs. So in total, we selected 14 programs to audit. The 14 programs are listed here. Again, I'm just doing this for context to get to the results. And of those 14 programs, what we were asked to do was look at internal controls and as well as render an opinion on compliance. And if you think about compliance basically falls into several buckets, including allowable costs, eligibility, subrecipient monitoring, funding levels, all terms that I think are familiar to folks when you listen to departments talk about how they administer their programs. So that was the objective. Now, if I get you to focus on F1, I want to talk about the results of those 14 programs that we looked at. And I mentioned we're going to look at compliance, and we actually render an opinion on compliance. And of the 14 programs that we looked at, 8 of those programs, we actually qualified our opinion on compliance, meaning there was something that we observed in our test work that indicated that they hadn't fully complied with the requirements put out by the federal government. And they're listed here on F1. And again, I will go into detail if the committee would like to, but just trying to kind of put a framework to what we did. Again, some qualified opinions. We also looked at internal controls relative to those 14 largest programs, and we had several observations on internal control deficiencies, ranging from material weakness, meaning the most severe in terms of weaknesses, as well as some significant deficiencies. And admin services will walk you through some of those statistics in a moment. So in a nutshell, maybe that was kind of a little bit of a high level plus a little bit of detail, but let me step back for a minute and maybe try to put all of this in context. So the states that KPMG does single audits for, you know, how would you stack up against those other states? Are your results better, worse? We're in that spectrum. I would say that it's quite common for states to have qualified programs. So New Hampshire is not an outlier in the fact that you have qualified programs. Many states have material weaknesses and significant deficiencies. So New Hampshire is not an outlier relative to its peer groups in terms of the audit results. I think what's also instructive, and DAS will go over this, is kind of what has been the trend line within New Hampshire. How many programs have had qualifications, how many material weaknesses, how many findings. And I think when DAS walks you through that, you'll see that you're kind of in a steady state, I would describe, over the last several years. So relative to your peer group, I would say you're kind of middle of the pack to better than other states in terms of compliance. And I would say relative to past performance with the state of New Hampshire, you're kind of in a steady state. So my goal this morning was to try to take something that's complicated and not make it more complicated. I don't know if I've succeeded in that exercise, but it was also meant to try to be high level. So I'll pause for a minute and see if there's any questions from the committee.
Senator Daniels has a question.
Thank you. You continue to mention about 14 programs on F2. But I can't seem to group things together to come up to 14.
Yes, that's a good point. There's this concept in the federal government where they take like programs and they call it a cluster. So if we take the top of F2, there's this highway planning and construction cluster. Even though it comprises several individual grants, it's in the eyes of the federal government, that's one program. So it's a cluster as a program. And then we have individual programs that aren't clustered.
Got it. Thank you.
Senator D'Alessandro for a question.
Brock, thank you very much. What I want to gather from what you're saying is there's a consistency that we're consistent in that performance and that we're not doing the same things poorly over and over again. Are we getting better? You said in our peer group.
Yeah.
When I look at the little composite, the composite kind of tells me that things haven't changed that much.
I think there are some
big improvement.
There are some situations that are repeating, and the way I like to describe an observation that appears in this report, in terms of timing, if you think about context, by the time we do we're auditing this program, we're already in the next fiscal year. So your year ends on June, but we're doing our audit work in September, really through the following winter. So by the time that we identify something, it's already reoccurring in the next fiscal year. So I like to say that just about every comment, most comments have at least a two-year life cycle in terms of appearing in a report. If you start to see something that's lingering for 3-4 years and beyond, those are the ones that I would focus on in terms of, you know, why aren't they being remedied? And sometimes there are occasions, and I'd have to go into the details to see whether it's here or not, but there are occasions where sometimes a finding will be chronic in the sense that it continues for multiple years.
Further question.
I noticed as we went through the budget cycle, HHS has had a problem, and they're being penalized about $3.1 billion. Now, I've been around a long time. That, to me, that seems to be a recurring process that we've not complied in a number of instances. And the other, this $3 billion thing stuck out to me because I think it relates to the MMIS program. And that's been going on for the 20 years I've been around here. I don't like that. I mean, if I were running the show, I mean, if I were the CEO, I'd be very concerned about that because I see it repeatedly.
Yes.
Is that noted in your findings?
I don't believe we address your particular question. There are repeat findings. Some of them have gone beyond the two-year cycle that I would describe, and sometimes that is because there is a technological impediment to remedying a situation. Sometimes it's a staffing issue, and sometimes there's a cost-benefit analysis, right? So we are somewhat academic in how we approach the results, right? So we follow the standards, and I sometimes tell my clients, if the cost to remedy is greater than the cost of compliance, you need to make a business decision. So sometimes there can be a valid business reason for a finding that repeats because the cost to remedy might be prohibitive to the benefit that the state might get. And us being academics, we have to kind of note that in our report. And we have those discussions with management to try to nuance the findings, if you will.
Can I just...
Charlie Erlinghaus from Edmund Services. I want to just to add to that, you can't have observed a budget for any length of time in New Hampshire without, you know, realizing that HHS has stuff going on a lot. You know, going back to, you know, 20 years ago, there was that we had to pay a whole bunch of money back. Yes. I would just say, in terms of the single audit, you know, obviously for the single audit people, you know, on our staff, the relationship with HHS is the one that is most dominant. It's where the money is. It's like there are a lot of programs, and it's not like anything else isn't important too, but it's where the money is. And are things happening? Yes. Are there findings? Yes. I would say that I would suggest to you that a few years back, from an auditing standpoint, our relationship with HHS was I would say, not strong, and there was some hostility in it, and there was some tension in that relationship where I mean, it's just natural, right? Because after there's always corrective action plans, and we send out emails to people, and they get annoyed because they're getting an email, and the commissioner is CC'd, and all that kind of stuff, and nobody likes to have an email with the subject line, corrective action plan. But I would tell you that today, our relationship, I actually was talking with Karen Rounds about this, some committee of conference day, Monday or Tuesday, and about the relationship between Steve Giovanelli and her staff that she deals with, which they're getting along fabulously, was what. And so the only reason I say that is not to say that there aren't still things we need to look at, but I would tell you that I think there's significantly there's more attention. People are doing better. People are taking it more seriously than they. And I don't mean to imply people didn't take it seriously, but good things are happening.
Follow up. I think one of the problems that we have had over the years is staffing. That's been a major concern. I appreciate the staffing over at HHS now in terms of the finances. I think that it's as good now as it's been in a long, long time. I think when Fredima was here, it was probably the best. It was really the best because he had been around a long time. He was very experienced. And there was good rapprochement in all sectors. It seems to me that one of the things that had fell this way was communication. That's been restored. We now have a controller, and thank God that you're still here and you're not going to leave us.
I'm still here.
But we had an extended...
Make her say that out loud.
I'm still here.
Control. So I think staffing is really the key issue. That's always been a concern of mine. But we have all of these vacancies in very key positions, and as a result, problems develop. So I just want to make that point, because as I say, I've been listening to this for a long time, and Brock, I think you do the best job. I think your precursor was awful.
Well, I was a precursor before this, so this was my second tour of duty, so maybe you remember me in a younger state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Made my point.
Any further questions from the committee? Thank you to the LBA for giving us this piece, showing us that we really have improved in the total number of findings, which were 2016 55 and now 25. So yes, thank you very much. You've made a difference here.
I just want to say, in Dana's defense, thank you to the LBA for passing out the document. But Dana prepared it. Right. And they both do a wonderful job.
And Steve Giovanelli prepared it.
And Steve Giovanelli. I want to say, I don't want to leave without
so who
saying
prepared
that.
It? You did?
Steve Giovanelli.
Steve.
And Dana's staff.
Another alumni of the LBA.
Well done. We're very well served by the staff that we have, and the single audit is one of those things that is, it is incredibly boring and annoying to a lot of people, and critically important to the honesty and transparency of the financial operations of the state. And there is a group of people in this room, I think it's 10 of you, I might have miscounted, who care about this, and there are probably hundreds and hundreds of other people who don't. I say that to Dana all the time, but it's... We can't run a business without it. The state is very well served by having perhaps the most efficient comptroller we've had in modern history. Wait a minute. But we have a very good staff, and Steve Giovanelli is in charge of the single audit, and he did prepare the document. But Steve has been on loan to Gopher for more than a year. Just came back in his absence. Matt Johnson, who was thrown into the deep end of the pool. And Matt did a stellar job in getting stuff done on time, getting it done efficiently, and managing to not turn every department of state government against him. And so I doubt he's listening because there's no Zoom function anymore, but we need to acknowledge that.
Representative Ober for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a statement, and I think I'm like everybody. We love this no matter who did it. But I think one of the remarkable things on here, if you look at 2016 and then you look forward to 2020, given the year we've just gone through in 2020, you might have expected us to look more like 2016, yep. But we didn't. And that, in my mind, is remarkable. So, kudos to everybody involved in this.
Yes, very much so. And forgive us if we didn't read every single page.
Until page 47 is particularly good.
Oh, I'll look forward to that. Any further questions on the audit?
Does Karen have that normal obnoxious statement of motion?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I'll recognize
whatever she says, I'll move.
Representative Umberger.
I move to accept, report, place on file, and release in the usual manner the
single
audit of federal financial assistance program.
Second.
Motion and a second. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, raise your hand. Okay, it's unanimous. All in favor. Thank you very much.
Thank
Please
you.
Stay on the job.
Thank you.
You got me.
All right. And we did have a question from Senator Daniels. We kind of skipped over the replies of those previous audits that we've asked people to send us. And is there anyone here from education? Yes, thank you for staying. Senator Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for being here today. Looking at your update, there's a column called Anticipated Completion Date, and there are a number of items in there that the previous column indicates that June would be your target date on that, and your completion date says June 2021 and QA work. Mm-hmm. And my question is, what is QA work? How long does it last? And at what point in time would you be able to mark complete?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Christine Brennan, Deputy Commissioner. This is our Director of Vocational Rehab, Lisa Hinson-Hatz, and our Commissioner regrets that he is not here because I know that that was one of the expectations since the audit has happened. The QA is the quality assurance work that we are doing. It was just approved by GNC on Wednesday, and basically it takes all of the work that was all of the recommendations that were given from the audit, and we have hired and contracted Stevens Group to help us with our trainings, with our policy, to make sure that we're providing quality services to our customers. And I'm sure Lisa wants to say something if that doesn't answer the question. And I think why you see some of these things that are not answered are because of policies. And our policies just before this meeting was approved by GELCAR, and the rules will be going to the state board in July to make sure that they're adopted and they'll be moving forward. So I think I answered your question, but in case, we have Lisa here as well.
I did just want to comment. Thank you for the question and for the opportunity. We're really excited about that contract getting started. I already had a call with them yesterday to set up our kickoff meeting on June 30th. But in reference to the June dates, just to follow up on that, we have moved most of those dates to December. And the reason why we moved them to December was because we had put our responses in and the dates of that commitment in the response to the audit, which took a few months to get through and get approved, and then we had to go through the GNC process for the contract. So that's why we're a little bit behind in terms of those dates, but the work is moving forward. So we're excited to get started. That is a two-year contract with them, so it will take us about 2 years to complete everything, but the first 6 months are the most intense work.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
So is it possible then to
include the estimated time it's going to take you to do QA so that you put down the audit commitment date as December, if that is in case. As I look at it now and something says in progress and it's June, it's like this open-ended, and I have no idea at what point in time things should be completed. If you had were to have another audit done, how would somebody know if that was complete or not? So I'd just ask if you could update those commitment dates to reflect the time that it would take to do the QA as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that actually will be sent to you, I think, on Monday for the July update for you guys, so you'll see all of those reflected in that December date.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Umberger.
Yes, I assume quality assurance won't suffer. I mean, that's an ongoing program. So I just want to make sure that we don't go through this one time and 2 years from now we're right back to where we are. Okay. Just
you. Yes. Good point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee members, we've had very lengthy reports for the last few months from both liquor and from education. Do we need these every month, or can we go to some different schedule?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Memrick.
In my review of this process, it became very obvious that monthly is too frequent.
I agree.
Because they don't have enough time between meetings to refile for the next meeting. So we might bring up a point that they can't even deal with because they got to get the next meeting results in. So I think quarterly would be perfectly acceptable.
Agree.
All right. So motion to do quarterly reports for both. Are you from liquor?
Sheriff.
Oh, you're with them. Okay. Quarterly reports from both liquor and education. I didn't mean to be insulting. I just thought somebody from liquor might have been.
It just comes naturally.
I thought maybe she was leaving.
All right. Motion to do quarterly from now on these responses. Question. Discussion.
Sounds like a good idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was the sponsor of the monthly requirement, and it was put forward because repeatedly, year after year, we would see audits that were done and items from audits done years before that had not even been addressed. Okay. Certainly, if the process isn't effective, I would favor moving it to a time frame that is. So for that reason, not to relinquish the requirement to get these things done, but to make it administratively possible, I would support this. Thank you.
So you are in support?
Yes.
Senator Birdsell?
No. Okay. I was raising my hand, yes.
Very good. Any other comments?
That means she's making the motion.
No, Tracy made the motion.
This is a motion. Senator Daniels.
Yeah, just one comment. For my purposes, and others may feel differently, but I'm more interested in seeing the things that are not done. I mean, there's a pretty good document here, but there's a lot of it that's already complete.
Yeah.
Those things, if it's not on the list, I'm more interested in seeing what hasn't been done in the past, where you are in the process, and when it will be completed.
Yeah.
Once it gets completed, I have no problem with it being dropped off the list.
I agree.
And Mr. Chairman, my motion also included this. The June report was the quarterly report for this.
So the next report won't be due till the next quarter.
September.
Representative Edwards.
If I could just comment on Senator Daniels' comment. When I've looked at these kind of documents in the past, there was some value, some utility to keeping the completed items on for at least one cycle so that you had visibility of when things moved from in progress to done. Because if it's just missing someday, you don't know, did they forget it or...
Right. So once it's been incomplete on an earlier report and it's complete on this report, we'd want to see that this has changed status. But after we've seen it and we've read that it's completed, then we don't need to keep seeing it again. Is that clear? Okay. Thank you for staying on the job on this.
No problem.
All right, all in favor of that motion to go to quarterly reports?
As described.
As described. Yep. Any opposed? It's unanimous. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I guess our next thing is the next date, which we'll discuss.
Yes.
With the LBA.
So the date of the next meeting, if you stayed with...
July?
What's that?
Do we meet in July?
No. It goes back and forth. You can... Usually there's one summer month you can skip. So if you skip July, you'd want to meet early August. If it's skip... but I'll leave it up to you.
What's the month you're gone? Both July and August?
No, I'm gone July. But my suggestion would be we skip a regular month, but if we have some ARPA guidance that comes in, we may have to understand that we would meet in that month for just ARPA. Because the guidance now is coming in. You don't know what's going to come up.
I wouldn't want us to go 2 months without having...
Yep.
A meeting if they had some time sensitive things. So I'm fine. I'm gone July 9th through the 18th, but I'm here the rest of the time.
Okay.
I'm going to Iceland.
Ah. Yeah. Any other preference, July or August, that's for skipping?
Let's skip July.
Yeah, I've got things I got to go to in July as well. So we'll. Have you got a date for August?
It's up to you. You could, if you stayed with the third week, it wouldn't be just 20th, but since you're skipping July, the 13th might be a good date it's the second week in August.
Friday the 13th, such a fortunate day.
I love Friday the 13th.
Whose birthday?
Russ's.
It doesn't come on Friday every year.
No, it doesn't. He wasn't born on a Friday.
All right, good.
And what was the reason for not going to the 20th?
You could go to the 20th, and if you just left it open, obviously if there's an emergency or if there's some ARPA funds that it's from timeliness, then we'll have the agencies reach out to the chair. So if you wanted to just stay with the third Friday, that'll be August 20th.
Because normally we're 4 weeks in between, but if we're skipping July, it'd be 5 or 6 weeks to Friday the 13th.
Yeah, I'm only saying that because that week I am gone.
Well, you're gone on the 13th. All right, so...
We'll make it the 20th.
The 20th?
20th works for me.
Not a problem. All right.
But, Ken, on this motion, do we have to say that the LBA can contact us if there are things that...
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that fiscal meet August 20th as needed, but are available to the call of the chair if ARPA money is needed.
Okay, that's the motion we have before us. Is there a second? Second by Representative Senator Daniels. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? There are none. Okay, very good. We appreciate all the fine work of the LBA, especially Pam Ellis, who takes the minutes.
Pamela is terrific. I want to say without a moment's hesitation, she makes pain worse.
She does what?
She makes pain worse.
Oh. Oh.
My wife's still in the bedroom.
Oh, I thought you said she took her cane out to make it work.
All right. Representative Daniels moves to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor? We are adjourned. Republican House members, 1 o'clock caucus. All right, Gary, take it easy.
Sure try.
Okay. Well, we gotta get ready to argue with our colleagues.
He was before the planning. It's going to be a pain in the ass.
Thursday.
That's just information that you can pass on.
Very good. You and I put the stuff in. I sent you the letter. You put the stuff in. Then they need to know. That'll change. And I'm trying to say to them, you've got a paper to be passed out to say, you know, look at all the good things you got. You list them all. And, you know, Charlie, you know.
So the statement that represented all the things we wanted to pass along to make my decision is going to be best for the Georgia.
So after they've got his
You're going to remember them. Exactly.